All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers, what the fuck buddies, what the fucksters, what's happening? I'm Mark Maron. This is my podcast, WTF. Welcome to it. How are you? It's a sad day, really. I have, not because of this. Well, you know, let me just set up the show. Paul Rodriguez is on the show today, and I've never met him. I know nothing about him. And that's rare because, you know, he's a comic. He's of a certain generation of dudes that I either knew about or ran into or looked up to at some point or another. But I really never talked to Paul. I never knew many of his friends. So when I got the opportunity, when he sort of came up, I thought it'd be nice to get to know that guy. So Paul Rodriguez is going to be on the show today. And the reason it's a sad day, I'm sort of breathy. I just woke up. I don't know why I'm exasperated. Maybe it's because I'm still in Birmingham, and yesterday I just held back, tried to, you know, hold back, hold, you know, don't eat that. That's the secret slogan of the South. Hey, maybe don't eat that. It's not that it's bad. It's that it's too fucking good. But yesterday I had the day off down here for the work, and I found a interesting little smoke shop, old school. Place where a guy carves his own pipes, has pipe tobaccos, some cigars. I'm having the occasional cigar. I know some of you know that means that maybe I'm drifting back into the nicotine, but hey, man, you got to have something, right? No, I'm not committed. But I went down there. It was actually in like an old house, and it was called the Briary. And the guy hooked me up. The guy working there, I think his name's Aubrey. And I just walked in, and he was just like, chipper. I had to be the first customer of the day, and I just walked in. He's like, how you doing? You know, like, right, very, you know, like, it was just so congenial, and so, you seem so excited to be working in a pipe shop. And there's certain, I realized, you know, he started talking pipes, he's talking cigars, we went in the humidor, we talked some cigars. We, you know, for me, I'm just, I'm just kind of a run-of-the-mill, you know, attic person. You know what I mean? I like the strong ones that make me feel things. What do you got that's strong and makes me feel things? That's how life's got to be for me. What, is it strong and make me feel things? All right, I'm in. But I don't want to feel things for too long. Maybe, you know, an hour, hour and a half. I don't want to be up all night. I don't want to be sad after. I don't want to throw up. What do you got? Strong makes me feel things. Good, hopefully. Makes me feel good things. Actually shuts out most things and just leaves the good thing. Or something, just a little hum. Can you get me humming? Is there something that you got here that'll get me humming for the morning? But no, but I never really met a guy like him. He's a full-on pipe, tobacco, cigar nerd, and very helpful. Hooked me up with a massive cigar that I just sat on the porch in Homewood, Alabama, I think it's in, and smoked that thing with a cat on the porch. I read, got into about 100 pages of the new Itzkoff book on Robin Williams, because I'm going to talk to Itzkoff. It's very good. It's so interesting to read that stuff. But I'll talk to you about that when I talk to him. You know, the Robin Williams book is it's good. It's very, you know, for me, you know, it goes far back, and it goes to, you know, it starts mentioning people I've known or I've talked to or I've worked with, and I get a little glimpse of their beginnings. But here's the thing. Philip Roth died day before yesterday, and I'd be remiss if I didn't say something, because he was one of the few guys whose books I would, you know, read pretty compulsively. I maybe it's being a Jew, maybe it's because he made being a Jew, American sort of middle class Jew, thoroughly interesting and defined and exciting in some ways, kind of pathetic in some ways, you know, but fully rounded. I think, you know, as much as American Jewishness affected Philip Roth affected American Jewishness. And the guy has written so many books, and he's one of those guys that just he was good all the way to the end, man. It's not a tragedy to some degree, because he lived a good long life, yeah, 85 years old. But it is, he's gone, and it's one of those things where I don't think he's written anything in a few years. And obviously, you know, all the material is here if you want. And there's one book that you should certainly read. Like, I mean, go out and get it ASAP if you can. I mean, if you want to fuck with yourself, but I'll tell you in a minute. But the thing is, not unlike David Bowie, who probably had a couple records in him, and I don't know if Philip Roth had any more books in him. I don't know. I think it's been a while since he's written. I don't know the situation around his death or how sick he was. I know he was sick a few years ago, but he was 85. Bowie was too young. But it's like when these people that, you know, you've grown to have a relationship with their work, and you see it on your bookshelf, or you pick it up and read a few lines, or you listen to it on a record or on your thing, you know, they it's comforting, or it's there's something feels like home about it, or feels defining, or feels like something that defines you, or something that you know is always there for you, and it is to some level as a reminder, or as something that, you know, you evolve with over time. I've always thought that great works of genius sort of evolve with you as you get older. You go back to them and they take on a new life. They imply something different. They affect you in a different way. But when these guys go off the physical plane, when they shuffle off the mortal coil, paraphrasing wrong probably, but don't know much about Shakespeare. So, you know, their absence, you feel in those days the absence. And then, you know, sort of the absence kind of, you know, hangs over the work. And it's not terrible. I mean, it's sad that they're not around, but it's sort of nice knowing that these guys are on the plane with us here. They're terra firma, if that's used properly, or whatever. And then when they go, they're like, oh, is that guy? Yeah, he's not here anymore. Oh, the books and the records and whatever, it's all here. But there's something permanent about the mortality thing, because so many of these cats who do the big work, who do the art, you know, are really sort of, you know, fighting against the dying of the light, you know? I mean, the weight of mortality. And well, he's dead. But the shit is here, and it's some of the best shit ever written. And the book, you know, it's sort of an outlier. Is that the right word? I'm like, I just woke up, man. I got to go to work. The outlier, or a unique book for him, was something he wrote in 2004 called The Plot Against America. And it's a fictional history infused with his real history as a child or a boy in Newark, New Jersey, growing up in the, I don't know, probably the 30s and 40s. But it really is about... it's an alternative American history where Charles Lindbergh, on a sort of isolationist platform, becomes the president. At the 1940 Republican National Convention, he's nominated and he's elected president. And he was pretty anti-Semitic. He was sympathetic to Hitler's government. And it sort of plays out like that, where you have an anti-Semitic president who is aligned with an anti-Semitic government abroad, and how that changes the country and what happens to the world. And it's a reaction from Jews. And it's a very detailed book, well thought out, terrifying, and so elaborately done fictionally that it's believable. And certainly... living through what we're living through now, I think it's certainly worth reading. But maybe it's not something people can handle now, given that, you know, we're sort of seeing a slow drift towards something awful in the government in terms of, you know, what democracy will look like if it survives, or even if we, you know, ever had it really. But not to get morose, but rest in peace, Philip Roth. He had a very profound impact on my life, and I don't know who I'm talking to right now, but get into those books. This is a funny little thing that I had with Sam Lipsight, my buddy, the novelist, who I didn't bring up the other day, but he's finished a new novel, which is fucking, I'm just thrilled, because I need it. I need a new Sam Lipsight novel. But Lipsight lends me his copy of Sabbath's Theater, which is a great Philip Roth book. It's not one of the ones that a lot of people read or know. It's about a It's about a former. The guy's a puppeteer. He's a political satire puppeteer, Mickey Sabbath. But it's one of the great sort of morally corrupt characters. But it's gotta be 300-400 pages, and I just love it. It's one of my favorite Philip Roth books, Sabbath Theater. And Lipside had lent me his hard copy edition when we were living in New York, and I read the whole book, and in the book, now, you know, Sammy's he's a novel, he's a writer, he's a great writer. So in the book, there's one sentence underlined. You know, out of like 300 or 400 pages, there's one sentence underlined. And I gave Sam back the book, and I said, you know, what was it? Why is that one sentence underlined? And Sam says, well, that's the best sentence in the book. Completely serious. He was completely serious. All right, folks. Look, Paul Rodriguez, a veteran comic. He's been around. Many of you know him. You know, he was one of the original-ish Latino comics, you know, post Freddie Prinze. And it's just a life I don't know anything about. You know, you'd see him here and there on TV, but he's always been working. He's always been out there. And I thought I'd take the opportunity to talk to him. He's Paul Rodriguez, The Here and Wow is a new special. It's available to stream now on iTunes, Amazon, Google Play, and most on-demand platforms. And I thought maybe I'd get to know him. So this is me and Paul Rodriguez back in the new garage. It's weird because, like, I was at the store. I never saw you around back then, but you were always a guy. Like, Paul Rodriguez was always a guy. But I don't know where'd you come from?
Off the bus, really. I came from Compton. I had just gotten out of the Air Force, but I was there early. I was there earlier than that.
I know. But, like, where'd you grow up? Compton?
Well, in Compton, really. But my parents were migrant farm workers, so they stayed in Fresno, and I'm the only one that left Fresno. I left Fresno because I had to go. So I moved in with an aunt. And then later on, my father had a farming accident. So it just so happens that Compton was one of the cheapest places to live.
Yeah.
So I wound up going to a school right there in Compton. I went to Ralph Bunch.
Yeah.
Ralph Bunch right there on Willowbrook.
And, yeah.
3 months after we moved in, the riots broke out. It was 1968, was it?
Oh, yeah. Wow. Yeah, the original Compton riots.
The riots broke out with... I remember one of my earliest memories seeing a Sherman tank parked right there in El Segundo and Willowbrook. And I have pictures of myself being the white guy in my school.
Yeah.
That's how black it was. I'm brown, right. And I was the white guy.
Right.
And I guess that's really what made me be a comic. I talked my way out of a lot of situations.
And did you have brothers and sisters?
I did.
My
brother George was a fighter, man. He looked exactly like this world champion Canelo Alvarez. My brother George he's not much to look at now, but he had flaming red hair and freckles. He,
yeah.
He looked the furthest thing from what you would stereotype a typical Mexican. And because my mom's German,
she's yeah,
of German ancestry. And,
but she was in Mexico. They met in Mexico because there was a lot of Germans in Mexico at one time.
A lot. In the state where I was born in Sinaloa, in Culiacan, where now it's famous because of narco trafficking and all that. I was born in Culiacan, and there were a lot of German migration after the First World War. They moved in there.
And they brought the accordion.
The accordion,
yeah.
They brought the accordion and the tubas.
Yeah,
and that's been incorporated into mariachi.
Not conjunto so much, music.
Yeah, conjunto.
Yeah,
the umpapa.
Yeah,
is you know, a lot of those songs. If you listen to them, they do sound alike.
I love it.
And it was that's where the German influence come from.
So your mom was a part of that immigration?
Yeah. My mom, every once in a while, when she would get mad, she'd scream at me in German, you know. Raus! I always, the joke was, I was a chica Nazi.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, they're not really known for stand-up comedy, so I didn't get it from her side.
The Germans?
The Germans.
Not that I know of, but yeah, not directly.
Not a lot of stand-up.
Yeah. But it's weird because, like, I don't know if there's more tension between Mexicans and blacks, but there seems to be tension.
There was a lot of tension.
Yeah.
I tell you, it was easy to be prejudiced and racist.
Yeah.
But as time went on, I made a lot of friends. And, for example, Kenny Landro from the Dodgers was my schoolmate.
Uh-huh.
He made it all the way. And I joined the football team. I was the kicker. And I have a picture of myself in the football team. Everyone's black by myself and the football coach. I wanted to quit because I thought it was football, soccer.
Uh-huh.
You know?
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Because that's what you grew up with?
Yeah, well, that's what I, yeah. I said, football, you know, a foot and a ball. And I remember looking at, the first time I looked at a American football, it seemed like the ball was oblong, you know?
Yeah, squished. Seen,
right?
Yeah.
I remember telling my mom, I said, you think we got it bad? Their balls aren't even round. it was like a deformed thing, and they would run with that. I didn't understand the game, but I could kick. And I kicked and
how old were you when you moved to the States?
I was 2.5, 3 years old. I have memories of it, very faint memories.
Yeah. And your brother's older or younger?
My brother's oldest. He was the oldest. My brother's, I'm 63 now. My brother's got to be close to 74 now.
But and then it's just the two of you?
No. What kind of Mexicans would I be? There's a whole bunch of sisters in between us. There's my brother Mario, my brother Javier, and my sister Ada.
And you all grew up in Compton. You're all in the same house at the same time?
No.
Because there's a big enough age difference where some people are out.
They were out.
Yeah.
I grew up with five siblings in Compton. They were still at home. And the others had married and moved on and stayed in the ranch in Fresno where eventually, as soon as I made money, I bought my parents a farm there.
And, you did? In Fresno?
I bought them a farm in Fresno.
Yeah. And they just came over just straight up migrant workers. They just came to farm someone else's land.
You know, I'll say this because I've never talked about this before.
Yeah.
We weren't really economic. We didn't immigrate for economic reasons. We immigrated for more of religious reasons.
Uh-huh.
See, my mother was Protestant.
Yeah.
It's very, very rare to have a Mexican-American who's a Protestant.
Right.
So I hated that because I lived a double life. I was Protestant at home and very religious Mennonite Protestants.
Oh, really?
Yes. And my father was a minister. But I didn't want to get picked on in school, so I had a crucifix that I would put under a rock outside the house. I wore a crucifix to be Catholic in school.
Right.
And I was Protestant at home.
Uh-huh.
But eventually that would come out, you know. And I remember my father was a pastor there at the Second Apostolic Church of Compton. And
he was a Protestant pastor.
Yeah.
So did he convert, or do you not need to convert? Because was he originally Catholic or not?
Yes. He was born Catholic. And,
right.
And he converted.
Yeah.
He converted to this faith.
Right.
And they believe, you know, they're very strict. The women don't wear makeup. They have to wear long dresses. They don't smoke. They don't drink.
Uh-huh.
They don't dance. They're very strict, you know, and Amish type of thing.
Right.
And I love music, and I love dancing. I love the girls. I love drinking. I did everything my father didn't want to. So my dad took me out of Compton because it was dangerous and stuff, and he sent me to Hayward Bible College in Hayward, California, to be a minister.
Oh, my God.
To be a preacher. And when I went over there, I ran into a lot of problems because we were all sexually frustrated. All the girls there and all the guys there.
Because it was apostolic Protestants. You couldn't do anything?
Nothing.
Nothing.
You'd go to hell if you touch yourself. You'd
right.
And every night, all you could do is... and of course, everybody was having sex. Everybody,
sure, of course.
And I was having sex also. And,
yeah.
And I got busted. I got caught.
Got busted?
With a girl.
Uh-huh. Naked?
Yeah, butt naked. having sex, and the guy that busted me really wanted that girl, liked that girl.
Yeah.
And I got thrown out. So.
And he got the girl.
I don't know. I never saw him again. But it caused my father a lot of consternation. And then I had to go before the church board, and I was considered a backslider. And by that time, I said, you know, Dad, I said, this is too strict. I can't live like this. I'm sorry to break your heart. And I got drafted, and I joined the Air Force, and I left.
Yeah, it's better to be Catholic where you can, you know, come fuck and drink and then just ask for your apology. Like, I'm sorry, I fucked it, drank.
You know, I'm Catholic now, and I always said that it's wonderful because Catholicism, you're allowed to fuck and to sin and to all these things. All you got to do is just confess.
Yeah.
Tell the priest who probably lives vicariously through you.
Sure. Apologize later. It's all good. You can do it. Yeah, yeah.
It is. It's one of the few religions that absolves all your sins. So I had to learn how to give myself the sign of the cross. And I had to learn myself to go to catechism. And
at what age?
Well, I didn't formally do it until my parents passed away. You know?
Really? So yeah. you had to you came into Catholicism late. Your right. birthright as a Mexican, you should have known it all along. Finally, you come back to the church.
I remember telling my parents, wanted to tell my mom and dad. You know, I said, you know, I want to talk to you, and they said, sit down, let me tell you. And right away, they my mom said, oh my God, he's gay. Sometimes he's gay. I said, no, Ma, it's just that, you know, I'm not gay. And I do a joke about that, but it wasn't due to religion. The joke was that I sat down and I said, you know, I'm thinking about being a Republican. And they said, oh, a Republican, I wish you were gay instead, you know. And it was, but that was the real reason. They very strict. No drinking. You'd go to hell for every reason.
But that's why they left Mexico, you think?
Yeah, they did, because my father was shot at and persecuted.
For being a Protestant.
Yeah, very, very, very.
No kidding.
Yeah. Well, a lot of people don't know, Mexico had a war. It was called the War of the Cristeros. I think Andy Garcia did a movie where the clergy in Mexico was so powerful, they had a stranglehold on government. So these forces, the anti-Cristeros, they fought. And eventually the Álvaro Obregón, a president there, won the war. And he was killed by a priest.
Oh, wow.
He was assassinated by a priest. But it's a very dark history of Mexico. Mexico still remains one of the most Catholic countries in the world. There's a city called Cholula where there are 365 churches in that one city, one for every day of the year. And they would tell the Indians who would make these churches that the angels at night would come in and build these churches. You know, the Catholic Church, the problems that I've had, the only reason I call myself a Catholic is because if we are going to hell, that's where all the Mexicans are going to be, you know. So I want to join them, you know. Religion has a very, very powerful hold on the psyche.
Yours?
Of minds and of us, because most Mexicans who come to America come for economic reasons. We came because my father was assigned to be the pastor in San Pedro, California, the first Apostolic Church of Compton. Then he got assigned to Fresno. And then from there, he just in time for the riots, he established a church in Compton. It's still there, the Apostolic Church in Compton on Rosecrans.
So they probably thought this was a great deal, because I would assume that as a Mexican, to do missionary work, to get Mexicans to come to this church.
And it was hard convincing them, because, you know, we love to drink.
And it's, but the Catholic thing's deep, man.
It is deep. It is to the point where, like...
There's a lot of saints. There's a lot of elaborate paintings. The churches are beautiful. It's 1,000 years old. Shooting.
Well, I'll tell you another story that's quite interesting. El Chapo, the famous...
Be careful now. I don't want to get shot. No,
the infamous drug lord.
Yeah.
Actually, how I am related to him is because his mother is also an apostolic.
Really?
An apostolic, and my mother and her are very good friends, and I remember meeting him when he was a kid.
So your mother's friends with El Chapo's mother?
They went to the same church and everything.
Is your mom still around?
My mom passed away about 4 years ago on Mother's Day. Oh. But she lived to be 93 years old.
So now you're practicing Catholic.
I'm not practicing.
Oh, you just...
But I identify, I've made a commitment to the jewelry.
Yeah.
You know, so I'd have to get rid of all the jewelry. The truth be told, the older I've gotten, I believe that mostly I believe in religion out of peer pressure, really.
Uh-huh.
You know, it's a sense of belonging.
Right.
But do I believe the dogma? Have I gone to confession and all that? No. No.
So so you tell your folks, you get sent home from the school for fucking.
Yeah, yeah.
And then you gotta sit down. Your dad's upset. Yeah. And then you said you joined the service.
At the time, I'm 63 at the time.
Yeah.
You had to I was drafted, actually.
Oh, that must have been towards the end, huh?
Yeah, the very end. And 6 months later, Nixon did away with the draft in 73. Yeah, 72, 73. By then, I had already, back then you had to sign at 17 before your 18th birthday. And lucky me, I was born in January, so my number was high.
Yeah.
So I got in. They give you the physical, and I went. I didn't want to go to the Marines. I didn't want to go. So I took a test. They gave you this little test, and I went to the Air Force. I figured, you know, if I have to go, the Air Force was you kill people from far away, I guess.
Yeah, that was the plan. But what ultimately, and what did you end up doing?
I got into communications. I was a communications operator, and then I went, and then I cross-trained. I became a loadmaster.
Where were you stationed?
I was stationed in Iceland, Keflavik, Iceland.
That was a lot. You saw a lot of action, huh?
I saw a lot of seals,
yeah,
and Icelandic women. I was stationed in a remote area in Iceland, which is remote enough, and called Hornafjordur, which was a radar site with 90 men. And way at the very, if you look at the Iceland, it has like a little, like a peninsula.
Yeah.
And we had a lot of, we still do, I think, radar sites that would track a Russian bear, the big U-2s.
Yeah.
That would fly to Cuba. That's where they would track them, you know. And well, it was a lot of boring hours. But what it did for me, it got me from the craziness of Compton and all of that. And I was lucky enough to meet my commanding officer, who took an interest, not in a gay way, but he took an interest in me, and he gave me books to read. He said, "Listen, if you want to go to college, you use the GI Bill. All you really need to do is to read voraciously." And he gave me a lot of books that were very difficult. You know, I read Solzhenitsyn's Gulag Archipelago. I had to read it a couple of times. I didn't understand, but it was about the Stalin
prison system,
prison system.
Yeah.
And I read, you know, the ones that the Animal Farm.
Oh yeah.
And I read War and Peace. There was nothing to do. There's no TV or anything. So you would read, and after a while you enjoyed it. I must have, for the year and a half I was there, I must have read a couple hundred books.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, I can't imagine. I'd never been to Iceland.
Iceland's quite a place. It was established by Leif Erikson.
Yeah.
And they still speak the most original Icelandic, which is the original Viking language. And it's a very, very difficult language. It sounds like, I knew a couple of words, because where we were at, there was a little town, Hofen.
Yeah.
We were allowed to go into the city there. Blacks had to leave by noon, and Latinos could stay there till 3, and then whites can stay there forever. And that had been going on for a while until we got a black colonel who was the commanding, and he made it off limits to all the servicemen. And within 3 months, the Icelandics were at our gates begging us for alcohol and please come back. And you know, nobody ever thought about doing that until we got a black colonel, and he put racism to rest there.
Because you guys were important to the economy.
Well, yeah, not only that, but at the time, liquor was outlawed in Iceland. So we were the only ones that had Jack Daniels, had these bottles.
So you guys would just drive in with the booze? Is that it?
And the girls would go, just lay down.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That was the intention.
You know, the thing about Iceland is that alcohol was illegal at the time, any kind of alcohol, but everybody was drunk. They would make their own stuff, a horrible tasting stuff called kurdus or something like that.
Yeah.
Made out of goat balls or whatever it was.
Right.
Fermented something. And that's what they would drink. They would drink, and they would it tasted awful. Iceland was they had a lot of Icelandic ponies, and you had a lot of goat and a lot of fish, and it was boring. It snowed terribly, and it was not a place for any tropical cat.
It was like the opposite from what you grew up in. And totally. I guess on some level that was probably a nice mind blowing experience.
It was
palate cleanser.
Yeah, I got to do a lot of fishing.
You
did a lot of fishing, but you know, there was
a hobby you've kept up with, Paul?
No, I let that go right away. You know, if I don't ever see another cod, I'll be all right. It was just a.
Yeah,
it was. You had to find something to do, and luckily enough, I got into I had someone that interested
the reading.
It helped a lot.
So, how long were you in the service total?
I did 4 years active and 2 years reserve.
And 2 years out back here.
Yeah, back here, which is one of the reasons how I got to know Carlin.
Yeah,
Carlin was Air Force, and so was Sinbad, and so a couple of other well known comics who were Air Force, and. I first got signed.
Before you started doing comedy, you got to know?
No, after I did. I got signed by a guy named Murray Becker, who was a legendary, he was supposedly the character that Woody Allen did about
Zelig or no Broadway Danny Rose.
Broadway Danny Rose.
Yeah.
At the time, he had George Carlin. He used to manage Carlins and Burns and Carlin. Leno was with him.
This was the guy, huh? What was his name?
Murray Becker.
Murray Becker.
Leno was with him. Yeah. Shannon was with him.
Murray Becker. So you come back from the service and you're back home. You're back in Compton. When do you start doing comedy? How does that unfold? I mean, did you do jobs, other jobs before?
I used to work at a furniture store in Gardena. What I did is I used the GI Bill and I went to Long Beach City College, which is basically doing high school all over again.
Yeah.
I didn't graduate from high school. It was impossible to graduate there. There was
2 years at City College?
I got an AA and then I enrolled in Long Beach State. And I went there, Spielberg's alma mater. I went there and I had a counselor there that said that if I wanted to be a trial lawyer, which I wanted to be, to take acting. Because basically all a lawyer does is you act in front of 12 people.
So you were doing like pre-law.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, I was. Right. And then this guy, one of your teachers recommends go to acting class.
Right. And it just so happens that her name, Anita Cano, I had a teacher that also taught Spanish because I was reading Cervantes and I was reading all of those classics, and her husband I think was worked at a firm that did accounting for the comedy store. And I used to make people laugh in the classroom, and Anita Cano was the one that said, you know what, you should go to the comedy store. And she took me there to Westwood on amateur night, and the minute I got on stage, it was an epiphany. It was like I remember I had no material, but at the time, the Los Angeles Police Department had shot a black woman named Eula Love.
Oh, yeah, I remember that. They shot her in her front yard.
In her front yard. Yeah. She had a butter knife, and they shot her something like 38 times or something like that. And the observational joke that I did at the time was they were saying, was this excessive force? And I'm saying, they only hit her 17 times. They shot at her 38 times. So I think if you have to reload... That is excessive. The cops have to reload and shoot this large black woman. It's a sad situation, but ironically enough, it just happened again in Sacramento.
Yeah, that poor kid.
18 times, And I think the reason is because the police officers don't come from that community, so they go in there with their stereotypes, and they're afraid. These are young; they're afraid. They see a black man in the darkness.
Sure.
They're going to shoot first. They want to go home to their.
It's not good. It's not good.
Yeah, it's not good. It's indefensible, but they'll probably be absolved.
They seem to always get absolved.
Yeah,
It feels like the system protects itself.
And I think a lot of us who are just listen to it as a news story. We have a tendency to bring our own prejudices in there. And we go, well, what's he doing? He's black. He's in the backyard. It's dark. He's holding a cell phone. All these things come into thought.
In his yard using a cell phone. Right. Clearly a threat to everybody.
Right. And what the police commission will probably say, they had reasonable fear for their lives. In the darkness, they put themselves. But in reality, when they shot, after they let go those shots, I have a friend of mine who's a police officer who told me that when an officer shoots, he's going to empty the gun. He wants this person to die. He doesn't want this person to survive and sue him. And that's
It's about lawsuits?
It's about you don't want this person to survive. They survive. They have the right to sue you.
But that's what's behind it, not just
that's what he told me. They're not taught this at the academy, but it's like something that's unsaid, but they tell you. That's why police officers, they'll empty that. Once they shoot, they're not going to shoot once and stop. They're going to empty their gun. And now think about all these shootings that have been going on.
Brown
in Missouri, they emptied their gun. They don't shoot just once and go, maybe that's enough, maybe he got it. No, they shoot the kill. They don't shoot the maim or these things about not shooting a gun off.
I guess the real question is the decision to shoot.
Yeah. Once that first bullet goes, all of them are going to go.
No, that's clear. Once it starts, it
goes. And that's it. They don't want this person to survive. You're shot. You should be dead.
What year was it that you went down the Westwood store?
It had to be, let's see, I got out of service in 77 and 81.
So it was late. It was, the store had been around since 73. It was like 81. So was Kennison managing the Westwood store?
Kennison was there. Yeah, Kennison was there at the time. He would hold court there when everybody was gone. And he was in the kitchen and he would do these long sets. And it was, and after a while, people started to know about it, and it became a, people left from the Hollywood store to go see Kenneth.
So, but you, when you started, you were just doing the open mic nights, and you took to it right away.
I did. But I figured I got big laughs the first time I went in there, and it was intoxicating. The second time, I died.
Yeah.
Terrible. So the third time, and I was taking a bus. That was during the time they had the Jimmy Carter had the gas prices. So my father had to stand in line to get gas, and it was hell to get him to lend me the car. So I had to take a bus, and it was really hard. So by the time you went there and you didn't get on, it was really, really a bitch. And then you go to the improv where you had to put your name in a hat, and Bud would pull out the name. And I went there three or four times, and he wasn't pulling out my name. I finally told Bud, I said, look, let me go on. If I suck, you don't see my face no more. And he goes, that sounds like a deal. And he put me on. I had a good set, and he let me on after that.
So you're primarily an improv guy?
At that time I was, but I'm one of the few guys that was allowed to go back and forth.
Why there weren't enough Mexicans?
I was a three-headed mule, I guess. I was the oddity, you know. Frankly, I make no bones about it. I use that. I made my bed, and I'm happy to lay in it, because at the time, I used to have a mustache. I favored Freddie Prinze, and girls used to tell me that, and you kind of look like Freddie Prinze. And really, that's what really impulsed me to, you know, a lot of guys said, well, I went into comedy, you know, to tell. We go in there to get laid, you know. There's something about the stage that attracts females or whatever. But I had a mustache, and I kind of favored Freddie Prinze. And Bud was the first one to go, take it off. Take off the mustache. He says, you can't compete with a dead guy.
Oh, yeah.
So I took it off, and then I was going to the Comedy Store on Monday nights.
Were you a fan of Freddie Prinze's?
I was a fan.
It's weird that, like, at that time, if you think about it, I mean, how many Latino comics were there? There weren't that many, right?
No, there weren't any at all. I mean, there was Bobby Aguayo. I don't know where he is, but he was a nice guy.
Yeah.
Bobby Aguayo and Danny Mora.
Danny Mora, right? Yeah.
He had a class, and I still look up to him, but none of them ever got their shot. Unfairly, too, I think.
Well, at the time, okay, so you did some open mics in Westwood, then you get in at the improv.
Right.
And then how do you get in front of Mitzi? How does that happen?
Argus Hamilton.
Oh, yeah, Argus.
Argus Hamilton had seen me, and he says, I'm going to talk to Mitzi. And he did.
Yeah.
He talked to her in bed, I think.
Sure.
And it worked. I went out there. At the time, I was a prop comic. I used to have the knife. My joke was the American Express card, and it was cheap. And you look back, you know, like most comics yourself, you might look at your tape of your early stuff and you go, you cringe, right?
Yeah.
But it worked. Yeah. It worked back then, and who could argue with success? Well,
did you have like a suitcase full of props? Was that?
No, I wasn't quite the Carrot Top I had a knife, and the joke was, at the time, there was a very popular commercial about American Express. They used to go, hi, my name is so-and-so, and when I travel, people don't know my name.
Yeah.
That's why I carry the American Express card.
Sure, yeah.
I would say, well, my name is Paul Rodriguez, and when I travel, people don't know who I am, but I carry the Mexican Express card, and I pull out this big old knife.
Yeah.
And I go, it's recognized and respected all over the world. Don't leave home without it. And audiences would howl. Mexicans, the Mexican-Americans would go, oh, that's, you're making fun of us, that's cheap, you know, all kinds of criticism. But I said, hey, fuck you. I'm not representing Mexicans. I'm trying to get a job here, you know? And that got me noticed. And Mitzi liked it. And she made me a regular. And I thought, oh, I'm a success now. But it wasn't like that. I was in charge of the parking lot.
Sure, I had that job once. You know, yeah. So you were a regular, and she gave you a job in the lot.
I said, oh, man, I was angry. I said, oh, man, what am I doing? And then Harris Pete, a legendary guy, he said, listen, Rodriguez, come here, let me tell you something. That's a great job. That's a really, really good job, because if Richard Pryor or all these guys with these fancy cars, if they're going to come and give you the keys to their car, they want to know all about you. They want to know who you are, what are you doing, who's this guy, you know? And true enough, it happened to be Richard Pryor was one of the guys, and I remember he sent me down to this liquor store to go get him a pack of Marlboro Reds box. Uh-huh. He gave me $100 in his car, and there I was, man, in his car, and I went there, I got him a...
Would you go down the Pink Dot on Sunset? Yeah,
it wasn't Pink Dot then. I forget what it was. It was a... three guys from Italy or something.
Oh,
like
yeah.
That.
It was a liquor store, though?
It was a liquor store.
Yeah.
I went over there, and I remember he gave me a $100 bill, and I bought two packs of Marlboro box and the change. And I went over there and I parked the car. And he was sitting there at that little table where Mitzi Shore sat.
In the original
right?
room?
And I said, "Here you go, Mr. Pryor." And I put the, and I count started to count out the change. And he looked at me like, "What the fuck are you doing?" I said, 20, 30, 40. He goes, "Get the fuck out of here. Keep it." I said, "You know, you gave me 100. I know what I gave you." He almost annoyed him. But I couldn't believe nobody ever tipped me. I think the cigarettes were maybe $6.
Right, yeah.
And I got to keep all this. That was more than I was making at the Comedy Store all week.
Yeah, and he was just hanging around then, huh? It was the mid-'80s? What was it, 82?
Yeah, he was working. But they weren't announcing it. He was preparing to do the
Live
show.
On the Sunset Strip,
exactly.
I think.
And everybody would come, as you would remember, everybody would come and they would all sit there and watch him struggle on Monday. You know, he'd go up there and he'd start on a bit and it wouldn't it wasn't quite done.
Yeah.
And
but to watch that?
Yeah. But as the week went along, by the time Friday, he'd add a little piece to it, and he would do Mudbone. He did the Dracula bit. He did all this, and Mooney really was the brains behind all that. And
Paul Mooney was working with him then, huh? Like he would sit there and watch him and make notes and do that whole thing.
I always thought that Mooney really was the. I mean, Pryor had talent, of course, but I always thought that Mooney was really the material was Mooney's.
Yeah,
Mooney would
come. He got it into shape.
Yeah, he did. He would basically give it, and then Pryor would put it together, and it was magic, you know.
Wow. So that partnership was pretty solid.
Pretty solid.
How is Paul doing?
Paul. The last time I saw Paul, I hear he's not doing well, and that's gonna be sad because when he goes, and Paul, if you're listening, I hope you're around forever. But when he goes, that will really be a milestone. I mean, Pryor got all the. You know, not to be corny, but the wind beneath his wings, really, because Paul Mooney was on Richard's show, and he was, but really the material, the genius, the biting,
he was like the guy that would, he was like half of Richard's brain.
I think so, because if you listen to Mooney, you hear a lot of Pryor stuff, and even some comics will accuse Mooney, goes, "Oh man, he's just doing, no, he was doing Pryor." No, the truth is, Pryor was doing Mooney.
Yeah, I believe, yeah, obviously, and then he co-wrote that movie, right? The JoJo Dancer movie, didn't he?
He wrote a lot of stuff. He and I wrote a script called Blaxigans, you know, and we were almost, we went down to Magnolia, the films, we had a deal, and then Mooney saw another black guy there that he didn't like, and he blew the deal on that. And I said, I begged him, I said, "Man, who the fuck is that guy?" He goes, "No, brother, this ain't going to go nowhere." So we had a deal for this movie, and then it wasn't, and it's still out there if anybody cares.
Because he got pissed off at somebody?
He was, you know, Mooney's still a very particular person. He don't suffer no fools, you know?
But when you were there in 82 or 83, parking cars, I mean, who were the people that you saw all the time?
Well, the big ones was Williams, the late great Robin Williams was there all the time.
Roseanne.
No, not really. Not right at that time. You know who was big at the time? The unknown comic, Murray Langston.
Oh, really?
Believe it or not, Murray Langston was the man.
With the bag on his
head? He was the man. Also, Letterman. Letterman. Sure. Letterman was emceeing a lot.
Really? When you were there in the 80s still?
But he had gone out with Helen Reddy.
Yeah.
Jeff Wall had taken up, but he would come. He was hosting.
Uh-huh.
He was doing hosting. I guess some of, you see a lot of the things that made him famous, his sarcasm.
Sure.
It was right there.
He was hosting in like the, in the OR?
In the OR.
Yeah, no kidding. Original. They don't even have hosts anymore.
They don't. Shanlon?
Shanlon
a lot. Who else was there? That was the heyday. As far as women, Elaine Boozler was the main one.
No kidding.
Yeah, Elaine Boozler, I've always thought
Sandra Bernhardt.
Sandra Bernhardt. I always thought Elaine Boozler, of
great.
All, the,
yeah, she was
all
great.
The comedians, she's the least underappreciated.
Underrated. Yeah.
Because she really did, she really took her job seriously. She really had good, solid material, you know?
So you were going on what, like every night and doing the lot? Was it one of those things where you were working the lot, then you have to go do your spot and then go back out to the lot? People would be waiting for their car.
Mike Binder would get drunk and you'd
Binder.
Went, Binder, what a great guy.
I saw him the other night.
Yeah?
Yeah, he's a good guy.
He's a good guy. I owe him so much. We hung out for a long time, you know, and I did. He's the first one that took me to Detroit. He did the Detroit Comedy Jam.
That's where he's from.
Right?
That was right. That was his show. He put that together,
Dave,
right?
Dave Coulier, Howie Mandel, and myself.
Yeah.
And had a great time there.
So you knew him before he got sober?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I party with him. He was a vacuum cleaner. He would. I had an apartment right there on, what's that street? There's a high, tall apartment buildings right there, right on Sunset Boulevard.
Oh, where it forks and you go up the hill there? Or?
No, the one that goes, the very next street where the Sky Bar is. The apartment's behind there.
Oh, okay.
I had all my money put it together and I got an apartment.
On Olive?
Right there, and we would go down. Argus Hamilton would go down there. They were all banging girls in my apartment, giving me coke.
Because you could walk from the Comedy Store.
Right, you can walk there. You take a girl there. You walk there, and you know the usual. Hey, I just saw your show. You were wonderful. Did you see the first or the second? You know,
that sort joke. Of thing. Yeah, yeah. Which set? Yeah.
Right. Exactly. Who else was a viable guy? That Louis Anderson.
Yeah.
He came in later. But Howie Mandel was
huge.
Huge.
Yeah.
He was doing St. Elsewhere.
Right.
Those were happy days. Howie was probably...
He wasn't big druggy, though.
No. Howie, yeah. I never did. Maybe he should have, you know? Because he wouldn't be so phobic now, you know?
He's got a little germ problem. Yeah.
Shandlin was probably the most amazing guy. I remember Murray Becker booking Shandlin and myself to do a Catholic college in San Diego. Yeah, he picked us up, and all the way down there, he kept saying, "Look, these goyim. They, you know, no, it's clean." I think I was getting paid $200, a lot of money. Gary, come on, you can do. I've seen you do clean sets. I've seen you do that thing about how people repeat their names at the airport. You know, looking for so and so, Mr. So and so. You know, do that. Do it clean, please. This is a very important account.
Yeah.
He must have said it 200 times. By the time I went over there, I did my set, and then he opened up with there were some nuns there, and he goes, "So, sister, you're gonna tell me in your whole life, you've never sucked a cock?"
Gary Shandling did that.
He did that. he said, but in his own way, you know, he did it. So, you know, like
you
that
never kind of, sucked a cock.
Yeah, so your whole life, you don't know, you never sucked a cock. And there was a suckening silence. Death.
Yeah, that vacuum
you
silence.
Know, it seemed like an eternity, and then the room just blew up.
Oh, really?
Big laugh. All the way back, I think they held a check. They didn't pay him or something. All the way back, Murray Becker's going, I told you, Gary, this is an important account. I told you, please don't use that filth. Where are you going with that? And then he goes, you never mentioned it. I don't remember you saying that. Paul, did you hear him? I go, I may have. I don't know what to do. You know?
Yeah.
He goes, no, if you said that, you should have told me. I would have, you know, I can work clean. He busted his balls. And Murray was a beloved guy. When he passed away at his funeral, I think only Leno and Carlin and about two or three. Even I was late to that because he had sent me off to Boston, I think. Yeah, he was a wonderful guy. I think he should be remembered. I hope he's on the web or something. Murray Becker, he was a.
So that was who Shandling was with before he went with like Brillstein Gray and whatever.
He was the guy that would find you.
Yeah.
And then then Brillstein or whatever, somebody else would come and take you.
Sure. Yeah.
It was a stepping stone.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
And it happened to him over and over and over. In my case, I got picked up by Sandy Gallen.
Sure.
And you know. It was really hard.
But yeah, what was your experience with Carlin? I mean,
Carlin was he was a different guy offset. He was very kind of. I remember I was on Venice Beach one time, and this guy with this hat and hair came up to me and goes, "Hey, I saw you on the Tonight Show. Look, it was a good set." And I was just kind of blow him off, and I go, "Oh shit, it's Carlin." He was very warm.
He lived down Venice, right?
I don't know where he lived. I never went to his house, but I know that he supported Murray Becker with money many times. You know, Murray was always going, "You need money for a plane ticket? I'll get it. I'll talk to Carlin." And Carlin was always good for money for Murray.
Oh, that's sweet.
Yeah, he took care
of him. Even after he wasn't with him anymore. Yeah.
I said, "When are you going to ask Leno?" He goes, "That guy's tight."
So what was your break? What was your big break? The Tonight Show. Oh, tell me about, like, I don't know if you talk about it, but like, You said you remember the night that Belushi died?
I remember being there, yeah.
At the store?
At the store.
Because that's where it started?
Well, every time a big stars like De Niro and was there, and yeah. Kathy was a staple. Everybody knew her.
The manager, Kathy.
No, Kathy was a dealer. There was a lot of dealers there.
Oh, the one that had right there.
There were a lot of dealers there that some of them were comedians, quote unquote comedians.
Sure, they're always yeah.
And Mitzi knew all of them because they would supply Argus.
Yeah.
And Argus at the time had a problem. We all had a problem.
Sure, but they're always around. I don't know who they are now, but yeah, that was the case when I was there. There was a few.
Everybody knew who they were.
Yeah, yeah.
And of course, Belushi was—he was God at the time. I remember I got him a pack of Vantage cigarettes. That's what he smoked.
Vantage
cigarettes. Huh. And I never
you were
heard
the
of
cigarette
him.
Guy.
Yeah, yeah. You know, whatever they wanted.
Vantage had the Target on it.
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah. That was, and I never heard of him, but I got him and I gave it to I gave him his pack, and he kept the change. He didn't give me no money. Let's just say that for the record.
Yeah. So Kathy was the dealer that was implicated in John's death?
Yeah, I don't know that, I guess. I don't know that to be a fact that she was a dealer or not. I knew that, you know how everybody knows.
There. Sure, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Somebody's looking
so she got the dope.
Yeah.
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 Yeah, and that's sort of interesting element of the story.
I went home, and the next day it was the biggest news, you know, that he had died. And then you go, it's like if you were at a party and you go home and then you find out that the place burned down, you go, whoa.
Well, the saddest thing about that is like having, you know, been around, you know, people doing drugs is that I imagine by the time it got to the point where he was doing that, like that, whatever the party was, you know, at some point it takes a turn and people are like, that's getting a little weird.
I never saw heroin, dark, though. I never saw heroin.
Yeah.
Heroin was a drug that the Vatos used in Compton or, you know.
Yeah.
Heroin was like, that was drugs. Coke wasn't considered a drug. And I didn't know about mixing or none of that stuff.
Yeah, I think that some people were like, I think some people secretly used it to come down.
It was innocence, you know, like it's robbed us of so many brilliant guys. The guy that everybody pretty much knew, he was with Three Arts.
Hedberg?
Hedberg, who's a legend now, you know, so many people. But you kind of knew because heroin was a jazz player's kind of thing, you know?
Sure.
And he had that kind of rhythmic, that kind of thing, you know?
Mitch, I knew Mitch, yeah.
I knew him in passing, but people knew that he used, but you never imagined him to do that. I mean, a guy's been doing that so long, you would think that they'd have control of it.
It got away from him. You know, I mean, there are things, you know, people didn't know until later, I don't think, but yeah.
Coke was kind of a comics drug, really, because it hyped you up. It made you happier.
Yeah, and it was everywhere.
Yeah, and you know, and you could tell the guys who were on coke up there because their jaw was moving back and forth. And I remember Kennison and all of us putting our dollars together, you know, hey, here, buy a quarter.
Sure.
I remember the first time I saw $50 worth of coke, I couldn't believe it. I kept telling them, come on, don't fuck around. Where's the rest of it? You know, it was this little package.
A little pile, yeah.
And we're at this.
That's it?
Yeah, that was it. I said, damn.
Where were you?
It was too expensive.
Yeah.
You know, we weren't making no money at the time. But the minute you did make money, the thing was you're supposed to come back and party everybody out, you know?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Right. Yeah. It's your turn to share.
Yeah.
To give back to the community.
When I got my ideal, I went back there and I had a bag and I remember all those guys.
When was your first Tonight Show?
Oh, it was after, it was when the premiere, A.K. Pablo.
Yeah.
That's when I got it.
That was your big break, your sitcom.
Yeah. I had tried to audition before and Macaulay and the Cordova said, well, you know, I don't know, it's too Mexican. But Norman Lear had a lot of pull in him, and he told him, and I did the set, and of course it was my dream because that's the first time I ever saw Freddie Prinze was when Johnny called him over. And I went out there and I did, and he called me over, and I sat down, and I did the Tonight Show 12 times.
With Johnny.
With Johnny.
Yeah.
Well, once with a guest host, she's still alive, the old, what's her name, Betty White.
Oh, she had. Oh, really? Yeah.
I did a part on
Golden Girls.
The Golden Girls.
Uh-huh.
And then she was doing the Tonight Show. She invited me. She's a sweet lady. She's still around, and man, it's unbelievable.
She's like 100, I think, now.
I don't know what she is, but you know, just to be all there. I mean, she's not Hermione's all there. Talked to her?
Same with Lear.
I saw Lear not too long ago.
Mel Brooks. There's some of them, the old people, they got the brains on fire.
The comedy has to have something to do with that, I think, because they're not the only ones. Some comedians, they either die really young or really old, you know?
Yeah. So what happened with A.K.A. Pablo? That was a Norman Lear show?
A Norman Lear show. You know, in hindsight, a lot of things. I knew there was problems at the beginning.
Yeah.
First of all, to white America, we all sound the same, but to Latinos, we know the difference between a Puerto Rican accent and a Cuban accent and a Mexican accent.
Yeah.
And they cross-casted. You know, they put my father was Joe Santos, Italian, and then my mother was Katie Jurado, Mexican. So it didn't work, but the attempt was good. They honored Norman Lear not too long ago in downtown, and I was there. I still thank him, man. He took me from sleeping in the car of the parking lot of the Comedy Store to put me in a tax bracket. That I'll always thank him for that. He gave me a pay or play deal for lots of money.
Yeah,
he was a very generous man. He wrote a script that's really funny. It's about these older people. It's called Guess Who Died. It's about these guys. I read for a part I hope I get it.
It's a new project?
It's a new project. I don't think I will, but just the fact that I was allowed to read for it.
So over the years after that, you did some other TV stuff, you didn't have like the long run.
No, I had no long run at all. Yeah. I did 8 episodes, and it's so ironic because I got canceled with a 28 share. You know what a 28 share is now?
I know, that's unheard of.
Unheard of, but yeah. Back then you had to have them in 30s or 40s.
Really?
Right? Yeah. It could have gone on, but I wanted to tell Norman, look, you're not doing this right, but I didn't want to come off as a smart ass, but I knew that it wasn't going to work.
Yeah.
Because still it doesn't work to this day. Latinos are a nebulous crowd, you know. To find a show that Cubans like, that Puerto Ricans like, that Mexicans like the only thing that they like is soccer. That's the only thing we have in common, you know. It's very hard.
Jane the Virgin's doing okay.
Jane the Virgin, that girl is...
She's great.
But if you notice, it's not Latino base. She just happens to be Latino, but her humor crosses over. She's a very nice...
It seems like the family situation is pretty Latino based.
You know, I'll be honest with you. I don't see it all the time, but yeah. She went to my house and I knew she was... Eddie almost introduced me to her. And I certainly wish her well, you know.
Yeah.
I did a play about the lack of I did a play called The Pitch at the Los Angeles Theater about that, about the absence of Latinos seen as how we're more numerous than African Americans, you know. And
why do you think it is?
It's our passivity. Huh. I think we don't protest. Not that protesting is necessary, but you know, African Americans complained a couple of years ago that the Oscars are too white.
Mm-hmm.
The business does have that it will respond to that criticism, but I don't think our day is going to come like that. I think there are shows that are a hit, but there are a secret hit among our community. But for a crossover show, it hasn't been since the Lopez show. Right now, there's one on YouTube about a Cuban family. I hope it does well. But there should be more. I mean, there's more channels. There's
George did okay, huh?
George did okay for several years. You know,
yeah,
he had. Back, he had great writers. The showrunner's probably one of the best, and it was funny. If you look at it, ultimately, I think nobody sits down to see a show about blacks or about Jews or about that.
Yeah,
they sit down to see something that's funny. If it's funny, it works.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and I hope to try again.
Well, I'm sure you will. So, like over the years, though, like you just kind of chipped away. You just kind of did gigs. You did specials. You hosted things. It's interesting because you're pretty much a household name. Everyone knows who you are. But you didn't. It's not like you did a Seinfeld. You just never went away.
No, it's fairly, I wouldn't say easy, but it's fairly possible to be famous for a year or two and then just fade away.
Uh-huh.
The hardest thing is to remain in the eye. You're always looking for some trick, some way, you know, almost ambulance chasing, you know, if there's a hurricane relief, you're there, you know, and you feel like some kind of a media whore. But if you don't do that, you're not going to sell tickets.
Uh-huh.
You know, and my whole drive was always to have enough of a name that when you're out in some city and your name's out there, people will come and see you, even if they don't know much about you. But if they heard your name, they'll come to see you. Then you got to do
it. But you also feel bad for the victims of the hurricane.
Of course, yeah. Yeah, you know, I hope Puerto Rico recovers right away. You know, I've been every hurricane, every comic relief.
Yeah.
You know, when Chris Albrecht was president of HBO,
yeah,
he was my agent at ICM, and he was very good to me. He gave me HBO specials that perhaps I didn't deserve. I wasn't prepared for that, but I took them, you know, and you learn. I'm comfortable with being the Mexican comic. Although if you look at my act now, it works in Rochester, New York. You know, you learn that, but I don't complain. If that's all you're known for, yeah, you're known for something. You know?
Well, there's definitely a Latino comic scene now. I mean,
there is.
And we lost Freddie a few years ago, Freddie Soto, right? He was great.
He was doing good.
Right? Yeah, and Madrigal. But there's a whole bunch of them. I need to get out more, you know.
One of the saddest one was he was great in the roast.
Geraldo?
Harvard educated, very intelligent. But again, he had some series. It didn't work. But his talent was amazing.
He's great.
I'm sorry.
Great comic.
He was really, really good.
Sharp guy.
He did. He had very astute points of view.
So when you did this special, like I was before you came over, I was thinking about it. I remember seeing the special you did at San Quentin.
Right.
And I thought that was crazy.
Well, it was, but I had it. How that happened was the Sunday Comics. Remember that they had that show? They decided to go to San Quentin, and I went there with Richard Jenny, Elaine Boozler, George Wallace. I forget who the other guy was. Anyways, and they told you don't jump out into the audience.
Yeah.
Well, I was the second to the last, and they had all done very well. And I said, "What am I going to do?" So I saw this huge Samoan guy, and I just jumped off stage and I just took a chance and I walked up to him and I go, "I hope never to land here, but if I ever do, I want to be your bitch," you know? And he stood up and he was a towering guy and he laughed, and that caught the imagination. Somehow people remember that, you know? It was kind of like when you did the Rodney Dangerfield special.
Sure, sure, right.
It was always one that stood out, you know?
Right, right.
It's a very gimmicky kind of thing, but it didn't really matter what you did as long as they remember. You know, you see a whole show and then you go, "Oh, so-and-so was good. Or so-and-so did this, or you did that."
Yeah.
When Bobcat, who's a brilliant guy, when he set the chair on fire on the Tonight Show,
yeah,
he never went back, but everybody remembers that. So sometimes you almost feel like you have to be like a P.T. Barnum in a sense.
Yeah, know? But you weren't thinking that when you did it, were you? You just sort of...
Well, I just saw Richard Jenny destroyed.
You need to do some crowd work. You got to do a little recon.
Elaine Boozler had a vagina.
Yeah. You
know, that was very popular in prison.
Yeah.
So... I saw this and I said, "Man, I don't know. I got nothing to lose." I jumped out there,
and it worked.
40% of the audience is Latino.
Yeah.
So you know, it was like a high school reunion, and I squeezed that out. You know, I did three HBO specials.
Well, I remember that. I just remember the special. It was crazy. I think Jeff Ross did one later at the prison, but like you did, like the first one I'd seen in a prison. The moment I remember is that, you know, prisons, when you're inside there, because I did a show at a women's prison once, it's a different world.
It is.
It's not comfortable, and it's a little visceral and weird. And like, I just remember when I'm watching yours, they kept like cutting to the audience. Yeah. And there were definitely some men who were dressed as women.
Yeah.
And there was a moment where I'm like, I'm not sure they want to be seen in the audience. You know what I mean?
You know, the camera is a weird thing. The camera, it is a drug. It's alluring to them.
Yeah.
There are people that would confess a crime just to be on TV.
Right.
And I remember what I did. I did a dramedy. I tried to do interviews, and I got an opportunity to interview some of the guys from the EME, the Mexican mafia, who really run the show.
Yeah.
How? I don't know, but they do. The cards will tell you. And I interview these guys, and these are guys that have done whatever they've done to get there.
Sure.
But what really astonished me about all these guys that I interviewed is that they're parents. You know, they're in jail, and they're concerned about their kids. They don't want their kids to follow them in the family business, and they use whatever powers they have to try to do that. And I remember them saying, look, one of them, I got a word, says, "Look, I want to be on your show. I want to say this to all the kids out there." And he said, "Listen, you, if you ever come in here, I will fuck you in the ass." And you can, you know, all this threatening him. And he goes, "Thanks, Paul." And I go, "Am I going to put this on?" And I go, I told my producer, I said, "I don't know." He goes, "Fuck yeah, I'm going to put it on." Because he told me, "This better be on." Yeah, I said, "It's going to be on."
Here's your PSA. Yeah.
So, and that hit a chord with a lot of people, got a lot of mail and stuff like that. And he goes, some of it was like, how can you put this killer, this guy did this, this guy did that. Yeah. But I also got mail from, you know, my kid is respects and admires that guy. He wants, that's what they want to be. And it straightened him out.
And, what show was this for?
It was for the San Quentin Live.
You interviewed guys. Yeah.
I went over there and I took Ice-T. He was a rapper. He wasn't all that well known, but
yeah,
he did that. And then I went, I did a show, but mostly I walked around the yard and I interviewed guys. I interviewed some of the Black Gorilla family, and some of the guys from the MA. And these are, it's very segregated in prison. I don't know if you're aware of that. I didn't have no guards, and they respected that. I didn't have no guards looking after me because I figured, look, if they're going to get you, they can get you in there. They can get you out there.
Yeah.
They got a long reach out there. And I interviewed some of the guys from the Aryan.
Yeah.
They all wanted to talk. And these guys are, you know, I said to myself, what am I going to ask these guys? And I remember asking them, do you have kids? And he goes, yeah. Do you have parents? Yeah. Would you like, and then just mention their kids, they become human again.
Uh-huh.
They start talking about, yeah, you know, I worry about this and I worry about that.
Right.
Because they must feel guilty about the, you know, being admired in a morbid way. I remember Richard Ramirez, the Night Stalker, yeah, wanting my autograph. And
he was there?
He was there at the time. He later moved. He said, hey, Holmes. Hey, I'm famous too.
That was it, huh?
He wanted my autograph, and I said, you're not famous. You're not famous.
You're not famous for the right reasons.
Yeah, you're infamous. I'll get back to
infamous,
you.
Infamous, right.
I didn't get bad. I didn't get nasty with him because he just had a really weird way. I met Charles Manson.
You did?
But he didn't want to go on camera. He didn't want to go on camera. He goes, no. He goes, he wanted to get paid a certain amount. That you know, he'd become real famous.
Sure.
You know, he had got married and everything. He had a hold. They told me that he had a whole male section just for him, that there were offerings of marriage and stuff. That is just...
Did you talk to Manson at all? I mean, or not really?
I said a couple of words, but he had nothing to do with me. You do that. You're the Mexican guy. Apparently, he got beaten up or something. He had a fight with some other Latino, and
I can't imagine being around those. It's just too weird.
But it was weird. It was weird because, you know, you've seen these guys, and there's a part of you that goes, wow, they're, you know, this is a good story, you know? And then it's another part of you go, this motherfucker stabbed a pregnant woman. Well, he didn't actually do it, but, I mean, he ordered that done.
Yeah, he's real evil in there.
So you go, fuck, I don't know how you feel about them, you know?
Yeah, the survival element in jail, what people need to do to survive in jail, there's an electricity to being in there that was just a little overwhelming for me.
It is so unbelievable. For example, Edward Olmos, who's a very good friend of mine, did a movie about the Mexican mafia.
Uh-huh.
The alleged, there's no such thing, by the way, let me just
sure.
say that.
Yeah, I hear you.
But they had wanted his death, you know, and I remember taking the opportunity to talk to a couple of guys and go, why would you want to do that? And the thing that bothered them the most was in the movie, there's a scene where they have sex, anal sex there. That's all there is, you know.
In jail.
But these are very, very macho guys.
Sure.
Who that's the only that's prison pussy, I guess.
Yeah.
And but they don't want that to go out.
Sure.
You know? And they thought that was he had broken that rule. And I said, you guys like to do your business in the dark and the quiet. If you ever hit Eddie Olmos, I mean, talk about the heat, you know. But on the other hand, what can they do? They're already in there.
Is he still around?
Eddie?
Yeah.
Oh, very much so.
Yeah.
Eddie's is a good guy. And as a matter of fact, we have a project together that we hope to do. It's three generations. I've been pitching it for the last 9-10 years.
Since there are only two generations?
There's three of them.
Now there is. You've been pitching it since it was two generations?
I'm trying to use my kid, you know. My kid is a very popular X game guy. So we actually shot a sizzle reel that Eddie plays a very racist guy stuck in his own time period.
Uh-huh.
It's three guys in therapy is what it is. We're just...
Oh, that sounds interesting.
And, yeah.
So what's the new special?
It's my au revoir. My it's my goodbye, really, you know. To be honest, Mark, I think that's it for me. You know, I'm going to do something that I've always wanted to do. And the next year or so, I plan to just cash in my chips and travel. I always wanted to go to Tibet. I mean, I've been around the world, but I've never seen it.
Yeah.
I land there, I do a movie, whatever it is, and then I have
to leave. Yeah,
but there's a lot of places I'd like to go without no time schedule. Just a to go there and travel all through South America. Go to Tibet would be my first place.
Where, Tibet?
I don't know why Tibet, but I want to go there. I've always had a thing about going.
And where'd you shoot the special?
I shot in farthest place from Tibet and in downtown Los Angeles and right on Skid Row.
Yeah?
Yeah. And then people came out. People came out.
You did it outside?
No. It was an old theater, the old Pan Pacific. You know, there's a lot of theaters that have Art Deco and stuff.
Yeah.
They shoot movies there. And I remember doing a movie called, with Mario Van Peebles. It was Sweetback's Badass Song.
You were in Sweetback's? You were in that?
Yeah, I was in that. And I was the Jose the filmographer.
Uh-huh.
Real good movie if you get a chance.
Yeah, I saw
and,
it.
And they filmed there, and I looked at this place, and it's got story. Because back in the day, people used to dress up. Going to the movies was a thing. You know?
Yeah, yeah.
Now, you know, some guy's jerking off. And
no one goes to movies.
No one goes to movies. Yeah. But the theaters that were Art Deco and beautiful, and we shot it there. And
that's great.
Came out good, yeah.
That's great, man. Yeah. So you're going to travel with no cameras. Just going to go experience it.
Just going to go, man.
You got a wife?
No, I have no wife. Okay. That's why I'm going to go.
Yeah.
I just want to go. You know, I read the Motorcycle Diaries. And
yeah.
I read Kerouac, and I read a lot of things. And I'm not doing this for any other artistic reason other than I want to spend time in Argentina, you know?
Yeah.
I want to sell the house and sell the whatever properties that I want to liquefy myself. And I'm not going to go ritzy. I'm just a backpack in an American Express or whatever, you know?
Sure.
I'm going to hostel here.
Yeah.
And, you know, I've been told that it's dangerous. But if I wait any longer, I'll be too old and too feeble, you know?
Yeah.
Right now, I'm still healthy. I can still walk. And
well, that sounds like a great idea.
Yeah, but it's not for sure. There's no taping or nothing.
Maybe you'll write something.
If I could write, I would. You know, maybe I want to go down to.
Take some notes.
I want to go all over Latin America, you know?
Oh, yeah.
I want to go to Belize. I want to go to Iztapa. I want to go to all those places, not as a tourist, but walk around and see where death catches me, you know?
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, hopefully, you know, maybe you want to catch death somewhere out on the road.
Well, my kid is always telling me, he goes, why do you want to do that? If you're going to talk like that, make sure it's nearby where they have an airport. I don't want to have to fly to Brazil in some jungle and find bits and pieces of you. But it's not going to be like that. I've always dreamed about going somewhere
and dying.
Right. Well, I've died plenty of times on stage, yeah. You know, for me to get a heart attack in Lithuania.
Oh, not Lithuania. Yeah. Make it nicer than Lithuania.
I want to go to the Czech Republic. I hear the babes there are.
Oh, yeah.
There's a lot of porn there.
Oh, yeah. That's it. So you want to go get involved in the Baltic porn business?
Yeah, you know what? I could just say, I bet I could star in some, you know, porn in East LA. Sure, you know,
Paul Rodriguez, his comeback is in the Lithuanian porn.
It could be worse.
He plays the Mexican guy.
Yeah, you'll notice. You know, that'd be a challenge, but I'd like to get a role. I'd like to be play a role, a Chinese guy, which actually I did in a movie with Burt Reynolds.
You did?
Yeah, a very forgettable movie called about volleyball team. I don't even know if it got released. But I would like to play someone that's not Latino. That would be the name of the movie.
Yeah, not
Rodriguez
Latino.
Is not the Latino.
That's a showcase for you.
Actually, I played Pacheco, but he was Latino, but not really. Dr. Freddy Pacheco and Ali.
Yeah,
a lot of makeup and stuff.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I've been very fortunate. I'm not going to win no Oscar. There's no danger of that. But I've done quite a few films that I got to meet a lot of people. You know.
Yeah, it seems like you had a good career overall.
You know, the pool's in, the patio's dry.
Yeah.
But I'm one of those guys that, you know, I never really hit, but I never went away.
Yeah, exactly. That's all right.
It's good.
Because you're still alive and you didn't have to deal with all that pressure.
And there's no sexual harassment. There's no There's no women coming out going, he fingered me without my permission. I did finger somebody, but I had to pay. I did the old-fashioned way. I pay for it.
All right, man. Well, it's great talking to you.
Thanks, man. Thanks for this opportunity.
And try not to die in the jungle. I think your kid's right.
I think I'll. I'm gonna travel, and then if I can remember what I did, I'll write a road story or something. You know.
Great. Thanks, Paul.
Thank you.
All right. So that was me and Paul. Seems like an okay fella.
Paul Rodriguez, The Here and Wow is available to stream now on iTunes, Amazon, Google Play, and most on-demand platforms. Dig it. Folks, I'm ready to get home. And when I get home, I'll tell you what I did here. Boomer lives!